Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is E.J. McMahon, who's an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute and research director of the Empire Center for Public Policy, an independent, not-for-profit, nonpartisan think tank based in Albany, New York. He writes on regional, state, and local issues, recommending policy changes and reforms to increase economic growth. Welcome, E.J. McMahon.
Thank you.
So, E.J., would you consider yourself to be a conservative?
Oh, I wouldn't run from that description. No, certainly not.
So you're a fairly conservative guy.
Yes.
You have written recently in the New York Post a very interesting piece, basically calling out Andrew Cuomo for some of his practices. Want to tell us what they are?
It was based on two things. One was the fact that the governor actually has shifted the state's tax burden. He hasn't so much reduced it as shifted it and made it more dependent on high-income taxpayers. So basically, he has, by extending the so-called millionaire tax, which he inherited and was going to repeal or allow to sunset because it was temporary, what's basically happened is that the state is more dependent than it's ever been on a pretty small number of very high-income households.
And what's the rule of those people who make more than...
On a tax filer basis, if you make more than $1 million and you file as an individual, or if you make more than $2 million as a couple, you're subject to this extra tax rate, which is 2 percentage points, which is a 29% increase in your taxes on the state level over what they were before. For most of the wealthiest people, by no means all of them, live in New York City, where they are also subject to the city's 3.9% income tax. What this all adds up to is those people pay the second highest marginal income tax rate in the country outside of California. And the problem is that the incomes of very high income people are very volatile. They go up and down. The incomes that plunge the most, the part of the tax base that evaporates fastest in a recession, especially in a bear market, is actually the higher incomes. Now, they're still well off, but they lose 30-40% mm-hmm. of their income in a single year. We're not prepared to deal with that, and so the state is more vulnerable to economic swings. The things that Andrew Cuomo has that have been enacted under Andrew Cuomo that have been described as tax cuts, some of which are actual tax cuts, some of which are sort of temporary tax giveaways, are all paid for by that one continuing, repeatedly extended so-called temporary tax increase.
Now, what do you mean tax giveaways?
Well, the classic tax giveaway, which predates Cuomo, is the film and TV production credit, which is a straight, heavy-duty subsidy of production costs for motion picture and TV in New York. There are smaller versions of that for things ranging from electric cars to you name it.
Is that a bad idea?
In general, I would agree with those who say that all that kind of thing is a bad idea. You should just have a flat, broad tax code with as few exceptions as possible and let the market decide the rest.
But EJ, don't we want people to come in here and do their filming and their television shows in New York City, and this is the incentive that gets them here?
Well, as the product of a media-saturated upbringing, I'm happy to inform you that many, many, many TV and shows and films were produced in New York on location for decades before we were paying people to do it here. One of the fallacies behind that credit is the notion that nobody would be doing anything here if not for that. By the way, that credit, if you were trying to promote that credit in any state, I wouldn't necessarily favor it, but I can see the argument more strongly in a place like, say, West Virginia.
Montana.
Or someplace. Yeah, someplace that it has like generic hills, trees, rural settings, and small towns that wants to compete for the realistic, effectively, backlot for the trees, hills, and small towns.
Yeah, but our big fight, right, EJ, is with L.A., for example.
Well, right, and L.A. for years has begun like doing its own film credit, not as generous, to get back some of what it seems to have lost to us. But I would point out to you...
Well, therefore, I'm going to call you on that. I'm going to call BS on that, because you're saying that they've lost something and that they know it, and that obviously redounds to...
It's all about opportunity cost, which is what else would you spend the money on, and it's about cost benefit. if you pay somebody to do something, they will do more of it. There would be 8 more public radio stations on the air right now if we were underwriting 35% of the cost of all of them, which is basic.
You are absolutely right.
So, I mean, anybody who had a hair of difference with you would start their own station with a subsidy from the state. What's happening is that the film credit basically pays people. It doesn't just make it easier. It doesn't just say give you a break. It pays you. It's a subsidy. There is nothing like it in any industry. It never has been. It's extraordinary. And to pay this highly profitable industry to do its thing here in New York, when New York offers, in particular, especially Manhattan, offers all sorts of advantages to those companies already. Now, one could argue that, well, the early years of the film credit, which started in 04, 05, started under Pataki, further incentivized the massive infrastructure that exists in New York now. Like, there were some growing sound stages then. There have been big investments in sound stages and production facilities. All right, you can make that argument, but I would say, okay, it's there. The money has been sunk in those facilities. The place is teeming with actors and writers and specialized technicians already. Back off and stop spending $420 million a year of our money to pay them to do what they do so well, because that can't be replicated in Cleveland or even Toronto, for that matter.
I got it. Okay, E.J. McMahon, let's go from there to Mark Molinaro. He is the Republican candidate to run against Cuomo. I'm astounded by how far the recent polls have shown Molinaro behind Cuomo, because Cuomo has a lot of problems. His top advisors are all turning out to be maybe we could say grafters. People like Joe Pococo, his so-called third brother, and Todd Howe, who used to work for the governor. And then a whole bunch of other trials coming up. And here comes Molinaro, and yet behind in the polls. What do you think that's about?
I would just say that anybody who is virtually unknown is going to be behind in the polls to someone who's known. Being in favor of Cuomo is not the same as liking him. So you
can say that again.
So there are people who are in favor of him, of his policies, who nonetheless don't like him.
So you think Molinaro has a shot?
I don't know who has a shot. I would just observe to you, based on history, that, you know, at this point in an election, when you're an incumbent as far ahead as he is,
yeah, Cuomo, with $31 million,
I mean, it's pretty hard. But I tend not to. There's lots of other people who follow the numbers more closely than I, who do the horse race thing. You know, can he catch up around the far turn? I don't know. I tend to try to be the guy who says, well, what is he offering as an alternative, and is it credible?
Well, let's go there. You've been writing about that, and you've been saying there's some very attractive things about what Molinaro, who I know and who I really have great respect for, nice guy, and has really done well as both the mayor and a county exec, but he has some ideas, and that's what you've been dealing with.
Well, I read his acceptance speech at the Republican convention, because up to now, understandably, like all candidates, he was basically saying, I'm a good guy. I'm not the incumbent. I'm a good guy. He didn't have particular specific stance. So in the acceptance speech, he begins to hint, and more than hint, at what his program's going to be. Unfortunately, those hints hint at something which is a wrong turn Republicans in New York began to take like 20 years ago, and which I suspect he's tempted to do again, because he promised a big cut in property taxes, so big it'll have everybody who loves the status quo unhappy.
Which is what Cuomo did coming in with his two and a half or whatever.
The one guy who made the status quo unhappy, I will say fully in his defense, was Cuomo. The tax cap, that upset Pete defenders of the status quo. When Pataki did STAR, and for those who don't remember it, STAR is the school tax reduction program, and essentially is a huge state-subsidized homestead exemption. It creates a partial exemption from school taxes for owner-occupied homes outside New York City. There's a slightly different structure in New York City. Period. That's what it does. It costs billions of dollars. While it was being phased in, there was an acceleration of the increase in school tax levies because schools knew they could it was kind of masked by that. When you subsidize something, you get more of it. Because remember, when you're running for governor or you're governor and say, I'm going to cut your property taxes, you're promising to cut a tax that's levied by somebody else. Governors don't levy property taxes. Governors create the conditions that drive property taxes. So my immediate concern when I read a statement like that was, here comes STAR on steroids, or son of STAR. The Senate Republicans for years have been promoting one sort of crackpot thing after another, basically some form of subsidy. Put a check in your mailbox. Where's your STAR rebate? And people pull these things out in September, this check for, you know, ranges from, you know, $32 to $180 or something, depending on where people live, and wonder what it is. And it's your Senate Republican-sponsored kickback of property taxes. Aren't we wonderful we cut your property taxes? And my thought was, uh-oh, sounds like something like this is coming. He also, well, basically his language was very broad and really said he was going to do earth-shaking things, and he was focused on property taxes. Well, first of all, you don't directly control it to property taxes. Second of all, what my piece was meant to do that was in the Post on Tuesday was to point out that there's some big fiscal challenges that will make it hard for you, putting aside other objections to things like that. There's not a whole bunch of $1 billion sloshing around that you can sort of redirect to property tax subsidies. So this so-called millionaire tax, which we were talking about at the top of our discussion.
And I wanted to get to follow up on that for a moment, EJ.
Yeah.
The premise on that millionaire's tax is that they'll move. Have they been moving?
Well, the premise is that they will either, that you'll have less of them one way or another through moving, or that they will do less of whatever they do here to make money. There's evidence that since 2000 that we've had an increasing erosion of the very high income payers who are participate in our economy. In other words, if you're in our economy making money here, you pay taxes to New York State, a sizable number, now over half of the people who report incomes of in the millions to the state tax department don't live in New York. And they're not just commuters. There's people who live in Florida, even California, other states. There's been a significant growth in the share of very high income earners in our tax base who don't live in New York. Now, I think part of that is a natural tendency. The wealthiest people in our society today are baby boomers who are all in the pre-retirement or retirement phase. And a lot of people don't retire in place. Talking about people in multiple residences, they retire to maybe the Wyoming or Florida or someplace, or not even a no tax state, maybe a low tax state like South Carolina, because of weather as much as anything. That trend was already happening. It accelerated a bit as we played with temporary tax increases earlier in the decade, first decade of the century. And what you're doing, and I've talked to financial planners about this, what you're doing is when you've got somebody who's making a few million dollars a year off of a good business of some type or a business partnership in New York, man or woman, they're in their 60s, they're already thinking, what are we gonna shift, you know, move this stuff to Boca, or, you know, what do you think? And like what they do is naturally they put it off. Well, I don't know. Let's talk about it again next year. What happens is, they're just basically, in other words, the rich are like us, only they have more money, like in the famous quote or the variation of it, meaning all of us have this conversation where we say, what are we going to do? Are we going to stay here, move somewhere else? Well, what this has done, the end of the federal deduction for state and local taxes, basically, in combination with this tax for people who have incomes high enough, that is a huge financial shove to settle your affairs and get out sooner rather than later. We have such an enormous critical mass of wealth, especially in the finance sector in New York, that we can lose wealth at a pace that in other states would be seen as a four-alarm fire and not even be noticed. Last month, a very old niche sort of investment firm, AllianceBernstein, which is the merger of two other older New York firms, announced it was moving its headquarters to Nashville, Tennessee. And half of their jobs, which is like 1,500 jobs, are moving with it. If you were even in Trenton, New Jersey, or Connecticut, or even Boston, and said a firm whose average pay is very high that's in finance and makes a lot of money is picking up and moving to Nashville, Tennessee, people would go, holy cow, what's happening here? New York is just so enormous. Goldman Sachs was like hundreds of times the size of AllianceBernstein, and it's staying. So you don't notice it. But I think there's a concern, and I think this concern is absolutely shared by people at the highest levels of government, including the governor. When you have doubled down and doubled down again on very high income taxpayers, and you've made your revenue base so dependent on people with very high incomes, you don't have to have a so-called exodus, which I don't think is going to occur. If you speed up the pace of corrosion or erosion in that part of the tax base a little bit, we're talking about people, each of whom pay as much in taxes as hundreds or even thousands of average workers. So over time, that can be a problem. You don't want to speed that up, especially if you're already dependent on them. So this tax is in effect. We've lost the state and local tax deduction. And that issue, which we've talked about here before, that's really about the high income. It does not affect the vast majority of New Yorkers negatively, all things considered. And what's happening is that millionaire tax next expires at the end of 2019. It raises $4.5 billion a year. So the first question Molinaro has to answer is, well, wait a minute. Well, before you get to all that, are you extending that tax? Are you going to let it sunset all at once? Are you going to extend it? Are you going to phase it out? What are you going to do?
That's where are you going to find the $4.5 billion?
And if not, where are you going to find the $4.5 billion? Because it's, I can tell you, you know, you can absorb the $4.5 billion in other ways without doing other new things that are needed to subsidize some allegedly dramatic property tax cut.
But by doing so, E.J. McMahon, you would be goring some very important axes like Speaker Hastie, for example, you know, and some of these other guys, right?
Well, look, the primary reason why New York has high taxes on the local level, basically there are two primary reasons. Our schools spend a lot compared to schools in other states in comparable places, which in turn is due largely to staffing levels and compensation. And Medicaid, whoever pays for the program, it's an expensive program. Now, it's actually, again, Cuomo, the growth in Medicaid has plateaued under Cuomo. There are ways to do better. We're going to be issuing some research on this from the Empire Center soon. But you can't turn around all at once and just like find billions of dollars lying on the floor in the Medicaid program. So this is a big task. And again, if you're thinking to do something dramatic that has a dollar sign on it at the end of the day, and if you don't talk about, first of all, tackling issues that and put you in conflict with public employee unions, number one. Two, making a decision on a big, significant temporary tax hike that's been extended repeatedly, you can't credibly promise anything else.
Okay. Let's go to another place. I'm fascinated by the Democratic-Republican balance in New York. Two things are happening. There are many people, as we speak, who think that the Senate Republicans are doomed. They're out. And the Democrats are going to take over in the New York State Senate. And there are those people who think, hey, when that happens, you know, you're going to have two houses given over to spending, the exact antithesis of what you're cautioning about, and two, Molinaro running for governor. But he has to walk around this monster known as Trump. I mean, New York hates Trump, so...
Well, now, wait a minute. A good part of his base does not hate Trump, and a good part of upstate does not hate Trump. And I'm not a Trump defender, personally, but if you think that Trump is like an unalloyed 100% problem for somebody running for governor from the Republican side, that's mixed.
Well, he is in New York. Let's put it this way.
He is in parts of downtown.
You may say upstate, and you may say, look, Zephyr Teachout won the upstate primary,
right.
You know.
Well, no, upstate is different in both parties.
Yeah, but upstate is not equal to downstate in terms of electoral progress. So Molinaro has to make a decision, right? He has to decide, am I going to keep my Republican base and the Trumpers happy? Or am I going to be critical of Trump? And if he's critical of Trump, he may get some votes.
Yeah, but he will lose votes among people upstate who like Trump. I mean, Trump has a spinally background of people.
But EJ, you got a Democratic candidate, Cuomo, a Republican candidate. I'm assuming it's going to be Cuomo. You have a Republican candidate, a Molinaro, and what can he lose?
What if there is a third candidate, for instance, if Nixon stays in?
Cynthia Nixon, Sex of the City, yeah.
That splits the left. It makes it all the much, much more important for Molinaro to hold his base.
Well, I keep hearing, and I know that you're not a political guy as much as an economics guy, but I keep hearing that the Working Families Party, which has given the nomination to Nixon, is going to insist that if Cuomo wins the primary, she gets off. Well, I think that's a disgrace, but that is what I keep hearing is going to happen.
It's early, and we'll see, because it's been a weird year already, of course, and it could get weirder. All I would say is just the general rules as I understand them are that you have to have, no matter what party you're in anywhere, if you're running a desperate uphill race against an entrenched incumbent, the first thing you need to do is secure your base, whatever it is. And that is a challenge for anybody who has whose base is divided, certainly the somewhat downstate, although again, I'd observe to you, in Staten Island and even in...
Come on, Staten Island is a pimple on the city.
Not in a vote count. In a statewide vote count, if you look at Staten Island, Suffolk, and Nassau, it's really interesting. I don't know if there's a Trump negative factor in those places or not. Westchester, there clearly is a Trump is a problem. And as you go up the Hudson Valley, there's a problem, and then it lessens. And then, I'm just talking to you from what I saw in the I was looking at the presidential election results the other day because I had barely paid attention to them at
the time.
Yeah,
but that was then. This is now.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I haven't seen any polls, and there's probably have been some, but I haven't seen it, is what his popularity rating is among the Republicans who support them. My friend Henry Olson, who I worked with in Manhattan for years, who's really the most astute political analyst on the scene today in many ways, I think. The guy is really fantastic. He wrote an article that was on an online publication the other day pointing out, and again, Henry's not a Trump fan. He's not personally a Trump fan.
What does he say?
He says people who think that Trump is increasingly unpopular and is a problem have to look at the actual numbers. And he points out that Trump's popularity rating is actually now, like at the end of May, just 45% or something like that, which is basically where George W. Bush was 2 years from his reelection. Similar things, meaning really popular among Republicans, totally unpopular among Democrats and independents. Now, I'm already like wandering out of what I usually focus on, but all I'm saying is I believe, you know, I respect those numbers in generally, and I respect Henry's analysis of numbers. I'm just careful not to accept conventional wisdom. I agree with you. It's a problem in the sense when you have a figure who's a lightning rod and a source of controversy in a place where a guy like Molinaro, who's completely unknown,
Trump doesn't even want to come in the city. I want to change the subject for a minute. We got 2 minutes left. You don't look like a pot smoker, are you?
I grew up in the 70s, so I have seen it. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
But
so now the big, and we only have 2 minutes, as I say, the big proposal right now is, you know, Andrew Cuomo was against it. Now Nixon comes in, says he wants it. Now he's for it. What are the tax implications?
I don't know the tax implications. I would say that between pot and sports betting, I think that's what's actually shameful is the extent to which so many politicians are willing to stampede in the direction of anything that'll generate revenue.
Okay. What's wrong with pot?
I think there are questions raised a whole lot of times about whether we needed to introduce into more and promote into more common use something that makes people sort of dim and apathetic and, distorts their perceptions of reality
or
whatever it is.
Or even worse, crashes into somebody.
I'm shocked at the rush to this, quite frankly. And did you know, and again, it's the Post, you may or may, I think it was very good reporting on the part of the Post.
It's the New York POS.
The New York Post. About how people in the Bronx, when the city council was talking about decriminalizing marijuana possession and open marijuana use, the people in the Bronx were really upset about this. Like they saw people who flaunt marijuana use as being also largely much of their petty criminal and nuisance class, and they're unhappy about it. And I'm not talking about Riverdale in the Bronx either. I would commend people to read that article. This, to me, is something that is in part being pushed by sort of a middle-class elite and not by people who would actually have to deal with the consequences.
Well, in any case, it's looking more and more like it's going to be a done deal. I see Speaker Hastie is now saying, okay, but then you have to let out everybody who's been convicted.
Right.
Because obviously that wouldn't be fair to them.
Well, this is a really big subject to be rushing to some completely radically new policy on in the closing weeks of a legislative session. This, of all the big things they've done in a rush, this would be one of the worst, which is really saying something, just out of nowhere. I'm not saying it's not worthy of debate, but just for this to come out of nowhere simply because it was pushed in a primary and it was the city council's latest hobby horse in New York City, that is amazing and not in a happy way, I don't think.
We are literally out of time. Cynthia Nixon wants a new Moreland Act commission to investigate crime. Can you give me a sentence?
Meh. I'm going to appoint a new Moreland Act commission. There ought to be a law. Look, elect different people, and people will swear up and down they've got higher standards than the guy who came before them. You have to.
Well, that's sometimes true.
Well, there is no magic bullet and magic prosecutorial body that will solve all of the issues.
Andrew Cuomo went around and appointed one, and then he dismissed it.
Here, in conclusion, is the biggest problem. We have too many programs that create opportunities for corruption. Bill Hammond, who works with me at the Empire Center, wrote about one this week, this Crystal Run case with the health facility in the Mid-Hudson. Why are we giving grants of $25 million to for-profit health partnerships to build anything? Why do we have such a program? This program wasn't invented for some nefarious purpose. When you have programs like that, you create moral hazards.
We know that from what's going on in the Cuomo administration.
Right.
But in any case, E.J. McMahon, we love having you here. You're a very bright guy. Our guest has been E.J. McMahon, adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute, research director of the Empire Center for Public Policy, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank based in Albany, New York. E.J., keep coming back. We love having you here.
Thank you.